Hello and welcome to the Thesis Driven Leader Series. I'm Brad Hargraves, founder and editor-in-chief at Thesis Driven, and your host here. Thank you so much for tuning in today and joining us. So most real estate developers are lucky if they find success in one category of real estate. Maybe a second. Maybe they get a second act and go from multifamily to office or office to industrial. Today, we're going to chat with a real estate developer who is a true renaissance man of real estate, who has gone across multiple categories, seen success, and built some truly incredible things. We're excited to have Adam Gordon, founder of Wildflower, here on the show today. So Adam is quite different than most developers in that many developers, maybe they come from a finance background, maybe a construction background. Adam is a real creative. His main project right now is Wildflower Studios, which is an 800,000 square foot high-tech film production facility right across the river from me in Queens, New York, which he's building alongside his partner, Robert De Niro. Not often you hear that either. Someone saying, yeah, I'm doing a real estate deal together with my partner, the incredible Robert De Niro. But that's not the only thing Adam Gordon has done. He's done a wide variety of real estate projects over the years, from townhomes to EV charging to building Amazon's first warehouse in New York City. So you want to hear what he has to say and what he's planning next. Before we welcome him to the show, I do want to thank our sponsor for season two of the Thesis Driven Leader Series, Neutral. Neutral is a multifamily developer that is really redefining the sector with a focus on sustainability, resident health, and well-being. They're building the tallest mass timber and passive house residential building in the U.S. with a state-of-the-art wellness club in Milwaukee. So beyond environmental impact, Neutral offers investors access to sustainable tax credits, deductions, and you can check them out at invest.neutral.us or connect directly with their team to learn more. So thank you so much, Neutral, for making this season happen. Now we are excited to welcome Adam Gordon, founder of Wildflower, to the show. Adam, welcome to the Thesis Driven Leader Series. Thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
One of my favorite things about your real estate career is you've worked across so many different sectors, from residential townhomes to logistics to film production. How do you decide what to do next? What does that process look like?
I'd say a couple things. The first is I define myself as an entrepreneur in real estate. I'm not a townhouse guy, an e-commerce guy, a storage guy, a studio guy. And I find that very liberating because it frees me to think differently or act on ideas and I think are important and timely. The second thing I would say is this is like bulletary. So if you had a kid and the kid was an amazing tennis player as a seven-year-old, you might send him down to a place called bulletary. Bulletary has spawned so many professional tennis players over the last decades. And that's because they're among other fantastic kids who are playing at a global level. I live in a bulletary world. My wife is a global hospitality designer. She formed a firm called Abrico with her college buddies. My pals are creatives like Phil Toledano, Andrew Zuckerman, who did the photography for the Apple book. If I'm out west, I might be hanging out with Bill Harlan, the wine guy who thought about a 200-year plan. This sort of hotbed of ideas being adjacent with inspiring people, that's where it all begins.
Would you agree with the sentiment that you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with, and that's part of your inspiration in the real estate game?
I hope so. Given the level of talent that I've been fortunate enough to surround myself with and cultivate over many years, it has had a dramatic input on the way that I think about nearly everything. I'm a New York-focused developer. This is my home. It's where I was born. It's where I raised my children. It's the city that I feel most passionate about. And I see a problem and a problem where I can act and have a point of view. I can perhaps build a building or a business or infrastructure with scale and impact. I'll start exploring and considering undertaking that challenge.
Just to get a little more tactical here, you built and leased the first Amazon warehouse in New York City. Are you telling me that you're hanging out with your friend who's really into wine in San Francisco and your wife who runs a design firm gave you the idea to build Amazon's first warehouse in New York City?
Take Bill Harlan's a great example. There's a lot of people who call themselves visionary. Not many of them accomplish much. They may write books. They love to give. We over-index for people who are articulate or glib. Bill gets stuff done. There's a bravery in that. When I first started reading in the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg and then began doing a deep dive about modern e-commerce warehouses, I looked around New York City and saw we didn't have any. I thought, that's a new building typology, the modern high-throughput warehouse. I can build one of those because I've built self-storage to very precise specifications. I began exploring, and I went down a very scientific, I would call it, due diligence process, which resulted in, once I was able to find the appropriate site and capital, building the first. Amazon came. They liked it. They were actually a little surprised that we had figured out what they wanted. And then it began a dialogue. We've now done 10 deals with Amazon and working on 11, 12, and 13.
This was a while back, right?
This was 6 or 7 years ago, literally their first.
Pre-pandemic, before people were thinking about this in quite the same way that they are today.
We met with a broker when we first acquired the site, and he was trying to pitch me on what he thought was the most exciting tenant to come into the market. It was a bouncy gym. And I said, let's kind of hold off on that idea because I think there's more impactful tenants available in the market. The education needs to be 360 degrees. First me, then capital, then leasing brokers, then partners, then contractors. In all this, being able to understand what everybody's need set is and then communicate in a way that people understand has value.
I want to talk about New York for a second, because you are a New York developer. I'm a New Yorker. I've lived in the city for more than 20 years. I think I can call myself that now. There is a sense to which New York is ahead of everywhere else in the country in many respects. But there's another sense to which it's behind in so many ways. I see what some people are doing in the Sun Belt. They're building multifamily logistics, et cetera, and like they're living the future. And you have your broker here, you're building a high-end modern warehouse, and they want to put a bouncy castle in it. What's your take on that? Do you think New York real estate is living in some respects, living in the past and the future simultaneously?
New York has always been a big, hot, sloppy mess for all the reasons that we love it and can find it frustrating. Unlike a lot of the guys in the Sun Belt who didn't start with fortunes, New York historically home to people whose grandfathers did something very well. When these people had money, inherited money, the one concern they had was losing it. And with that fear went away all their inspiration, desire, willingness, and compulsions to grow. I didn't begin in this business with any money. And so I had to figure things out. And I find that very healthy. And so therein lies a lot of the challenges that New York has. There's also a tremendous amount of momentum because of our restrictive zoning environment and the political atmosphere. It's very difficult to get something done here, particularly something novel. I'm hopeful that the city of yes, over time, is going to continue to be an instrument of innovation. I think the people at EDC are particularly able right now, and I've enjoyed my interactions with them. I look at a city full of hope, and these frustrations also, for me, are the same frustrations any other developer has, and they create a series of moats, which make it much more challenging for competition to come in here and succeed.
It is certainly a double-edged sword in that it is hard to get things done, which also means it's hard for other people to get things done, which means if you are able to get something done, you have a natural advantage and a defense there. And you look at people building similar things in Dallas and other Sunbelt cities, and not much is preventing someone from going to the empty lot across the street and building the exact same thing. And especially in 5 years when your project starts to get a little age on it, there's a blessing and a curse to being in and operating in this city. I do want to talk a little bit specifically about building a film studio in New York. What was the case for building Wildflower? And tell me a bit about that journey of getting like a modern scale film studio built in Queens.
It's a big subject. It's important to understand what motivates anybody. For me, I'm motivated by trying to be helpful. Of course, there's an economic opportunity that is associated, hopefully runs in parallel with that. But for me and for my partner in this case, De Niro, we want to help because we build infrastructure to create a more friction-free environment and a novel environment in New York City. We also build buildings and infrastructure that attract and hold the kind of people that make our city diverse and unique and interesting and compelling. This was the latter. This was an idea of creating a permanent home for artists. As I explored the business, just the same way I explored the modern e-commerce warehouse, I saw that studios that creative people spent their careers in were not very creative. They were these dull, tired warehouses, not built to any particularly careful spec. And they were also really dehumanizing buildings. And we're all affected by our environment, particularly creative people. I thought if we could, and it evolved in this theme of performance meets poetry, I thought if we could create a high-performance studio building for production the same way we did in e-commerce, and we could create something high design and high poetry so people would look forward to coming to New York and working at Wildflower, we would have something incredibly valuable and beneficial to the city and to filmmakers who come here.
So tell me a little bit about working with the city. Did you have to go through any special zoning, special process? And on the flip side, I assume, you know, the mayor's office, they have a big office of media and entertainment, would probably be excited about this. Would love to hear just a little bit about your relationship with the city as you went through this process.
Working in New York City is like my first day at school as an undergrad at University of Michigan. There were 17,500 undergrads. I was one of them. And you're on your own. It's like a Greek and Roman city-state. New York, you're pretty much on your own, and you got to go figure it out. We were planning on building our studio right next door to where Amazon's HQ2 got turned down a year earlier, Long Island City. It's the rise of AOC. It was very hot. And in fact, AOC has refused to meet with us to this day, even though we're the largest new employer and certainly the most creative employer in her entire district. So that tells you the fragmentation, it's wild, and the hostility in New York. On the other hand, because oftentimes people are misunderstood, the unions working in the studio were the Teamsters, incredibly helpful to us, helpful in design, helpful in navigation. We started off in this process really parallel to our design, going out and explaining what we were doing. And Rafael De Niro, Robert's oldest son, and our other partner and close friend, Rafael and I held over 40 meetings to share with people what we were doing, to listen and to learn. And so we got into a process and developed some momentum where people understood that we were trying to create a home for filmmakers and that we were creating lots of good jobs in New York City and that we had thought about developing the studio in a way which would minimize the detrimental impacts of a big structure like this on a neighborhood. We were fortunate in having a partner and a partnership who's already done so much for New York City. You think about Robert De Niro's contributions to the city, and they're numerous.
So tell me, do you want to drill in for a second on your partnership with Robert De Niro? Did you know him previously? Did you kick around like the idea of building a big studio in Queens? How'd you get him excited about it? I'm just curious.
I would say a couple things about Robert. The first is he has secret skills. He's actually a fabulous designer. He understands the psychology of space. He understands how to create environments that make people feel loved and protected. He is a foodie, very passionate about it. I remember the first time I told him that we had found this site off market in Astoria. I said, I'd love to go see it with you. We were down in Tribeca at his office, and he said, let's go. And I said, when? And I was thinking it, week, 2 weeks. He goes, now. And we went downstairs. We hopped in his car. We went to the studio. He loved the site. We drove back. His partner, Jane Rosenthal, was there. He said, Jane, you've got to see this. And Jane said, sure, when? He goes, now. They went and left again. That's him. I would say the other thing about him, which I've noticed now spending 5 years as a business partner, is everything he does points true north. He always wants to do the right thing, and that informs every single decision. So we were friends for 20 years before this started, but I've really enjoyed my working relationship with him immensely.
That's an incredible story. And he went back out to Queens.
Back out from Tribeca to Astoria.
back across the bridge or tunnel. And wow, that's amazing. So tell me a little bit about like where it's progressed. What's the state of the project today?
We opened last fall on time, on budget. It's 17 jobs in a row for the Wildflower team, bringing budgets and projects in on time in New York City. The studio is now filling up with tenants. It's been a slow start in the industry after all the strikes. We're excited, and the people who come through the studio who've spent decades working in the business say that it's a revolution. I love the way they're stealing a lot of our IP, and it's starting to fertilize new studios around the globe.
So the tenants are film production companies. They're film production companies, and they're signing long-term leases for chunks of the studio space.
I love hearing you talk about it, because this is exactly the way I talked about it when we started in the business. We had the advantage of two partners, one who knew everything about the business and the other who knew nothing. I'm not even a film nut. I actually have very lowbrow taste in movies. I won't even bore your audience, but I could ask questions from first principles because I didn't know anything about the business. And Robert could bring all the experts to bear so we could approach this very forensically. But if you think about what's filmed in New York City, it's everything that you would watch on Netflix, Amazon, or Apple. Any serial TVs, companies come in, sell a production to one of what they would characterize the media companies or the streamers. With that budget, they would go out and rent space from 3 to 10 months typically in order to film their production episode by episode.
Interesting. We did just have an episode of Law and Order filmed at our house, which was like a totally bizarre experience. That's the only thing I know about this. Otherwise, I know nothing about this. But they came in, they took our house over for a week, and they filmed it. There was like a fake bomb in our living room, and there was like a kid who found it. It was the craziest experience. So it's the only thing I know about this.
So they toggle between filming at a home like yours and a studio like ours. All the location shoots, it's one of the many reasons, beside talent in front of and behind the camera, living in New York, but also all these great stage sets, which are our city. So they'll come in and shoot on location and then come back and shoot on sound stages.
I know I'm going to get asked this, so I'm going to throw it out to you. The long-term view on the studio space market in a post-AI, post-video-generated world. What's your take? In 10 years, are we going to all be watching like AI-generated video, or is there still a role for studio space and actors out there?
I think a great analogy would be the office market. The office market post-COVID is a number of different markets. 9 West 57th Street is always going to be full. The GM building, new buildings in Hudson Yards, always going to be full. But if you're a side street building in Midtown, you are in real trouble and ought to think about other uses. I'll say exactly the same thing about the studio business. AI is going to significantly reduce the amount of production shot anywhere other than on a laptop. The best studios, our studio, Steiner Studios, a few others, will always succeed. You always need to bring actors into sound stages, but not at the volume and velocity they have in the past.
Yeah, it's the same as the office market. I love that. I love that analogy of if you have great space, there will still be actors who are at the top of their game that people want to see. It's the middle and lower rungs. Does make me wonder, what does the talent pipeline look like in the future? If there are no jobs for B-list actors, how do we get A-list actors? That's probably a conversation for another thing, but I'm curious your take on it.
It's fascinating. People talk to me a lot about getting in the business, getting in a business, getting into e-commerce, getting into storage. The conversation, which is as important, is why do I get out and when? How do I think about that? Because to me, my skill is as much in knowing when to leave the party. For example, in e-commerce, I handle all the leasing at Wildflower at a high level, meaning I have those relationships with Amazon. And from those conversations, and Amazon is not telling me any secrets, they're a publicly traded company, but I could see the momentum shifting in Amazon early on because I was on the phone with them all the time. I was talking to their teams. I was working on leases. And I could see that they had become the biggest space occupier in history in America and that their appetites were being satiated. And at that moment, I stopped. So we built our last Amazon e-commerce warehouse just as many people were getting into business. But they were reading the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and talking to their friends at Real Deal conferences and BizNow conferences. They weren't really close to demand, and they had no idea that business was about to capsize.
Right, and that was 3-4 years ago, turned south really fast.
Sure. But is it really fast if you were close to leasing and you understood that was happening? So we stopped long before that.
When was it? When did you stop? When did you say, when did you call it and say this, we're going to see a shift in warehouse demand?
A couple of years ago, we saw a shift in demand. We also saw too many people running in the market. We saw a lack of product market fit, which unfortunately also has evidentiary problems. People say this building is empty. I'll say that's because they built two stories of warehouses. No one wants that, or it's the wrong size. Amazon doesn't want 1 million square feet in New York City in one building. It's not the way delivery works, or last mile delivery. So we saw that, and we also saw too many people pushing in and driving prices up to the point where the margins weren't there. It was very obvious to us that we were ready for a pivot.
So I want to shift to the kind of development you actually did prior to even getting into the warehouse business, which is townhouses. You're a renaissance man of real estate development. You've been in a lot of things and really been at the top of your game in a lot of different real estate sectors, which is one of the reasons I'm excited. Townhouse development is a little bit of a lost art. Feels like that to me. If you look in the history of New York, Philly, Boston, Chicago, any of these cities, and the townhouse, the row home, it was the staple of how these cities were built. And now we barely build them at all. And so I'm curious your take on kind of a bit about your time in townhouse development and your take on that typology.
For many years, I was moonlighting. My day job was developing urban infill self-storage, and my evening job was building townhouses. That was really because, like many people, I've got some secret skills. I designed the architecture for our house in California, which was an architectural digest. My wife and I do our interior design. It's been widely published. So I have these other skills and interests and things that intrigue me. And I long enjoyed kind of having very design-driven evening hobbies. The other part of it was, when I began in the townhouse business, there was a tremendous arbitrage from going from multifamily vacant townhouses to single family developed townhouses. And the relative price per square foot was significantly lower than an apartment of equal location and equal size. And I liked them. I got into the townhouse world. I bought a 24 foot wide vacant house at 92 Jane Street for what everybody thought was the obscene price of $3 million. You could renovate a house for $300 a square foot to a high level. I sold that townhouse to Steve Ells, who founded Chipotle Grill, for $13, $14 million. And it was my evening job. I loved the design. I lived in the homes. So from the time older son was born until he went to college, we lived in 9 homes. We packed and unpacked a lot. But it also gave me kind of an expression for my design jollies and some good money in the evenings. And it was a big part and chapter of my life that I've enjoyed very much.
It's just remarkable going in the New York real estate market and looking around how much at a very high price just does not come with a strong design sensibility. And I get, to an extent, it's built for other people. But it's remarkable the alpha you can get from just having a good design eye on this kind of thing.
People are typically either left or right brain. And that's great. You just have to know it. They're incredibly talented designers, and it's an art form finding them, and it's another art form getting them to do their best work. And so it's something to be cultivated if one has an interest. But there is a lot of bad design out there. One just has to walk down the high line and see some of the best architects with the worst buildings.
I'm curious, you've worked across so many different asset types, so many different categories. You worked with cities in a lot of those dimensions and a lot of those projects. What do you think cities could be doing better right now to make for a better built environment and to enable people like you that are going and creating good projects out there?
It's all about zoning and capital. We need more statewide zoning and national zoning because the NIMBYism, the community groups, the local zoning is so inhibiting for development that we're at a position with a great city like New York where we're plus or minus a half a million homes short. A friend of mine was just telling me how proud they were to find a one bedroom for $7,000 in Manhattan. That's just absurd. And what that does also is it keeps out a lot of the most interesting people who work in creative businesses who don't find themselves earning monster amounts of money. And I think that's sad.
It has to be a huge headwind to the film industry in New York that so many people who make the film industry work and frankly make the most interesting creative content out there just cannot afford to live in the city anymore.
It used to be that artists would just go out one more subway stop, but now you've got to go past the end of the subway line because of housing costs. There aren't that many problems that can't be solved in the city by housing. The homeless crisis can largely be solved, right? The creative crisis can largely be solved. Like, people raising their kids in the city can likely, all of these stem back to the cost of housing. And the only way to solve that is through zoning.
Yeah. City of Yes, obviously, you mentioned this earlier, was a big reform passed by the New York City Council in December of 2024, ostensibly creating or legalizing 82,000 new homes. Did a lot of good things. It significantly cut parking minimums in a lot of places. It upzoned these kind of transit-oriented centers, but it was also cut back a lot from what Mayor Adams originally wanted to do. And I'm not a huge Eric Adams fan, but I'd give credit where credit is due. He's a YIMBY. He wants to build more housing. And it was the New York City Council that reined him in there. I think that was a miss, but I hope some good things come out of it.
Yes, that's why we need state and national zoning, because people like Mayor Adams, City of Yes, people operating with oftentimes the best of intentions cannot make progress because they don't have the authority to.
I'm really curious what national zoning would look like with the current administration, but maybe we'll leave that thought exercise to another day. So are there any cities you look at and say, wow, if New York could model some of what that place is doing, we'd be a lot better off?
Every place I've traveled and spent significant time, Copenhagen would be my model. I go down, have an incredible breakfast. There's so many options. There's lovely community. The pace of life, to my timbre, exactly right. I'd hop on a bicycle and ride around along with 40 or 50% of the people in Copenhagen. The bike lanes are protected. I'm a bike commuter in New York City now, but it's not without some risk. And there's just a life there and a lifestyle which is satiating and happiness inducing for so many people. So I really admire all the things they've done right there.
I have so much respect for you commuting by bike in this city. I can't do it. I want to see my kids graduate high school. And when I feel like every time I hear about a peer of mine dying at some unnaturally young age, it is always a car running into and running over a bicyclist. And it's a tragedy. It's terrible that we don't have better infrastructure in a place like New York, where, frankly, a bike is the best way to get around, just from a geographic standpoint.
99% of those accidents are avoidable at low cost. And again, it's all politics. There are many people who will not give up their car or their free parking on the street, which for me makes no sense. I don't understand. You have to pay rent, you have to pay taxes, but you can park a car on the street forever and not pay for that privilege.
It's absurd. I live in Manhattan and people just store in their cars on the street forever. The same I walk down the street, the same cars are parked in the same places. They're not cleaning the snow off. They're storing them. There's nothing else in the city where we just give space away completely unmonitored for free. It's insane.
Yes. And then when we try to have garbage in containers, which is a pretty simple and logical thing, so that it's not a rat festival at night walking down streets, people are up in arms because they don't want to give up a single space for the car they barely use.
I don't understand it at all. And I talk about why I'm not a huge Eric Adams fan. A lot of it comes back to that kind of thing. It feels like there is a better world at hand and we are simply choosing not to go there. Let's just take a step back. You've obviously worked across a lot of different real estate projects. A lot of our listeners are real estate developers at the beginning of their careers. What advice would you have for a real estate developer, someone who looks to you and says, wow, that's a career I would love to have? What advice would you have for them today?
It is both a wonderful and a terrible time to have a career in real estate. It's a wonderful time in that it's never been easier to attract capital for good ideas. The ideas in broad scope geography have never been more inviting. People are much more receptive to novelty and evolution than they've ever been, in the sense that, and you see it on your podcast, the venture community and mindset has infiltrated real estate as never before. The bad news is, if you think you're going to have a career doing the same thing that people used to do before, you are going to get run over. People are getting disintermediated. Banks, private equity firms will pay you only one penny more than they have to, certainly none of the upside. The analyst, associate, and a lot of the vice president class at the investment banks is going to be gone in favor of AI because it's natural and normal. And so this idea that the innovation economy is innovation only is not the mindset that I would recommend that you spend time in. I would say this is the only way for you to find not only alpha, but to find a stable career, is to think about what's next, because embedding early and right comes opportunity.
I love what you said around earlier. Maybe I'll bring that in. Getting to understand and know demand as a competitive advantage. The future of real estate is innovation in these novel asset categories. You can't do the same thing you've always been doing, but how do you identify them? Is it about knowing demand and where demand is headed?
I spend 20 or 25% of my time learning every day. And people think maybe that's because I'm lazy and unfocused. Possibly. I'm not sure that would be the outcome from those facts. I would say that I'm investing in myself and the world and trying to understand and intercept where demand is, where ideas are, how to execute better and different, and develop relationships. And also because it makes me happy on a daily basis. And I think for anybody considering a career in real estate, to think very carefully about how to compose your day, because out of that composition is going to come the outcome. If you just go into work, grind it out, go home, barely talk to your significant other, if you have one, not see your friends, new and old, or not have any new friends, you're going to have a very different life than if you invest in yourself and also take advantage. If you're fortunate enough to live in a great city, and there are many in the States, take advantage of this city because you're paying for it, but you want to make sure that you're getting the benefit of the barter.
You spend a quarter of your time learning. What does that look like? I assume it's not doom scrolling on Twitter. How do you define learning?
This morning's a great example. I listened to your podcast on the way down. It's an episode with the former president of Warburg. Really found it fascinating. And I took a couple notes of things I'm going to Google later. Then I listened to Frank Kistler do a podcast on their winery, Occidental. And it got me thinking about that. I raised Japanese Wagyu beef, Knights Valley Wagyu. We just got the slow food snail of approval a couple of weeks ago as honorarium for the work that we're doing in the restoration and support of local food communities. I texted a buddy of mine who I'm going to see later in the week to get together and hang out. I exercise, and then I go and I'm certainly reading the New York Times every single day. I love the Post. It's my guilty pleasure. And then I go and start to do deep dives. I'll read Monocle, and no day really looks the same for me. But I'm going to be, if I were going to count the hours, I'm going to be reinvesting that way or focusing that way, certainly 20 or 25% of each and every day.
I love that. It's everyone, people talk about learning, but understanding like tactically, what does that mean to you? Because for some people, they're like, oh, I'm learning. I'm scrolling on Instagram and like Twitter or whatever. I don't know if that counts. It depends on who you follow, perhaps.
If you sit around and your social life is going out every Friday night with three lawyers and two bankers, and you wonder why you don't know anything other than maybe what the hottest restaurants are in St. Bart's, it's no surprise. You can choose what you invest your time in, and there's never been a better moment to learn because the resources are effectively free and ubiquitous.
I look at this and I see what's available out there to learn, whether you're talking about more listening to a podcast or, hey, I'm going to go onto YouTube and pick up some skill. It's more just like, it's a cornucopia and it's only limited by our own time and a need to sleep. It's an incredible moment in time. So last question before we jump into the lightning round. You've obviously done a lot of interesting things and jumping between different real estate sectors. What's next? You're obviously still in the thick of it with Wildflower. If you were to pick another sector to tackle, what might that be?
We're developing the largest electric vehicle charging center in New York City at JFK Airport. We are about to open a second one at LaGuardia, anchored by Revel. We're on our third at Hunts Point, developing EV infrastructure to power the clean energy transition is incredibly important work for the planet, for the city, and therefore for us. It's smaller scale than other programs I've been involved in. It's absolutely as big an impact as anything I've ever been involved in. And we're very focused there. I have been quietly for the last 7 or so years. My first meeting with Amazon, I asked them one question. To kick it off, I said, how do we keep you happy for 40 years instead of 10 years? They said, V charging. It's not here yet, but we're going to need it. When those delivery vans come in, we need to charge them up. And so the first parking lot that we developed with Amazon on Flatlands Avenue in East New York, if you go by and see it, you'll see that they're now charging delivery vans there. And so that sort of set me off to thinking about the future of parking and charging.
It's my view, and I've written about this a bunch on Thesis Driven, and so this is hardly a secret, is the one technology trend that everyone in real estate is sleeping on more than anything is autonomous vehicles. They're not just coming, they're here in a lot of cities. You go out to west side of Los Angeles, you go out to Phoenix, go out to Austin, and you can request a Waymo, and that will drive you anywhere in more or less in the metro area. Certainly in Phoenix, that's true, less so in LA. It's here, and those are electric, and they need a place to charge, and that doesn't necessarily have to be someone's home or office. So I think these electric vehicle charging stations, and frankly, the need for utility hookups on those, are going to be a bounty on those in the next 5 to 7 years.
The biggest single theme, if I were 21 or 22 coming out of school today and I wanted a career, let's even put aside a career in real estate, is climate change. Climate change, infrastructure, adaptation, that is the most important, impactful, and profitable work any of us can do over the next lifetime, forgetting even my lifetime, and certainly over the next lifetime. This is one aspect of it. It's going to inform prop tech. It's going to inform real estate. We see it every single day in the newspaper. Our weather's become increasingly volatile. And one item that we've barely seen, we saw a couple buildings collapse in Florida. The average age of a building, for example, in New York City is approximately 53 years old. We're going to see building collapses. We're going to see issues with our aging infrastructure. We're going to see bridge collapses. And I don't mean to be dark about it. Out of these problems are going to come opportunities for people that are well positioned.
So that's a note to end on for sure and move into the lightning round. Quick questions, quick answers. First question, what's a startup, developer, or entrepreneur you're watching closely and why?
Urban Rigger in Copenhagen, floating housing. So imagine water being a new form of land, a place to build housing at scale. I serve on the board of Urban Rigger now to hopefully bring them to America, but I can't imagine a more novel idea. Bjarke Engels was the architect who built the first one, which is in Copenhagen. If you go there now, you'll see a very underutilized piece of waterfront became a home for riggers, a community, and then within 2 years, coffee shops and restaurants opened up to support that newfound community and life.
I love that. You're going to see a floating community on Jamaica Bay?
I hope so. Any of them.
That'd be fun. Next question. When you and I are recording this podcast in 10 years, in 2035, what's the most important real estate tech topic we'll be talking about and why?
Clearly, climate change adaptation. And so everything related to them. I think another company that I admire tremendously is Icon 3D Printing. What those chaps are doing is brilliant and is so incredibly important. And I went down to Austin to see them. They're literally printing a house in 4 days, and the product and the delivery is sensational.
Next question. We talked about this a bit earlier, but what's one city or place you would bet on?
In terms of the place I would always bet on is New York City. If you look during COVID, for example, in VC, you saw a dispersion where people went everywhere and then a reconstitution. VC is Silicon Valley and New York City, and it's because it's a kind of city that has it all for people, right? Educated workforce, incredible restaurants, vibrant nightlife, infrastructure, kind of the works.
Very hard to overcome agglomeration effect. Frankly, the benefit of New York's awesome legacy infrastructure that would be impossible to rebuild today. Last question. What's your favorite app on your home screen?
There are two apps. One is Bring a Trailer, which is a car auction website. I'm a car nut, and I find myself scrolling. I would never say doom scrolling. This is cars. And the second is Headspace. And it's the app that I use on a daily basis to slow down and take 10 minutes and just do a reset with a meditation.
I love that. Adam, thank you so much for joining Thesis Driven Leader Series today. Great conversation. Really happy to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you all for joining this episode of the Thesis Driven Leader Series. I really encourage you to check in next week as well. We have a really exciting episode dropping, an interview with Minna Song, the co-founder and CEO of Elise AI. We just profiled it in Thesis Driven a couple weeks back. It's one of the most exciting and successful AI companies in real estate today. Minna and I are going to talk about a wide variety of topics, from the role of AI in real estate, her journey, building a prop tech company in 2025. What does it all mean? So we're going to hit a bunch of things. Going to be a fun conversation. Really encourage all of you to join in, and hope to see you next week. Thank you.